From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The appointment of former FBI Director Robert Mueller as special counsel for the Department of Justice investigating any links and or coordination between Russia's government and individuals associated with the Trump campaign was at the center of news reporting Friday morning. For more on that, we spoke with our regular political contributor, Professor Tony Montero.
As is apparent to everybody, the political system is being severely tested. It is destabilized. The party system may never recover from this. The competing and contending sides in both parties seem to be coming more antagonistic. And the type of unity that the Democrats would need going into the 2008 congressional senatorial elections doesn't exist. Really, the type of unity that the Republicans need between the House, Senate, and the White House to even get through a minimal agenda of repealing and replacing Obamacare, tax reform, mainly for the rich, and certainly the $1 trillion for infrastructure is impossible. And in the wake of all of this, Trump is on his way to over week-long foreign visits, where it looks like, in terms of foreign policy, the coup has been effective, that he is back on, quote, back on track to do the bidding of the neocons. But where that will lead is not certain, because the real event of the last week or so is the One Belt, One Road summit held in China, where 28 heads of state attended, including Putin and Duterte of the Philippines, and I don't know who else. And the world economy continues to move forward away from the U.S. dollar and away from U.S. neoliberal control of the globalizing economic processes. And I guess the other thing are the elections in South Korea, where the liberal peacemaker won and is already making overtures to North Korea. So that is what the major events are. I think, and I'll just end on this, Trump's going to the Middle East is like, at least to the countries that he's going to, is a sideshow compared to the big events which will affect for generations the trajectory of the global economy. And those events were occurring in Beijing and not in Washington.
Yeah, that Belt and Road conference was interesting. If you listen to Xi's presentation, for example, Putin also, but Xi, you know, is swinging the stick of the China, you know, economy of China. You know, their plans for the next 10, 20, 50 years are to develop, you know, the center of gravity of the global economy there, with some very concrete proposals for transportation infrastructure and other things that are in the process of being built. The financing and the planning and the approvals and everything are well into process. There's some shovels in the ground on some of the major projects already, and it's something that isn't likely to be derailed by anything other than perhaps World War III.
Right, that's right. And it is very interesting. You could call it an African-Eurasian economic belt. Because it is, in its initial foundational stage, it is building this global infrastructure that links Europe, Asia, and Africa in a single economic, trading, financial zone, which will not be based upon the U.S. dollar or the financial markets in the West. And this is just, this $1 trillion is just the beginning, the down payment. This will go far beyond that as we go into the 21st century. And the United States is embroiled, as is many other Western countries. In fact, the whole European Union is embroiled in internal political struggles of the neoliberal elite and the financial ruling class growing increasingly antagonistic towards the working classes, the middle class, and young people. And this is what all of these political struggles are about, be they in the United States or France or Greece or Italy or Spain or Portugal and so on and so forth. I mean, the West is looking inward. The rest of the world is looking towards developing new relationships that are not dependent upon the U.S. dollar or Western hegemony.
Yeah, and they're developing the wherewithal of, you know, independence, and they're looking towards the future as well, with a path from here to there being constructed before them on high-speed rails and other. And, you know, you talk about the integration of Africa into this economic structure, and that's the string of pearls that they refer to. And you can also look eastward from China towards Latin America. You know, the project to build the canal through Nicaragua, deep water ports across both the west and east coasts of South America and Cuba and other places. And then, you know, the plan to build the Transcontinental Railroad across South America. These are all infrastructure projects also that China has on the board and or in development. And so the reach of this Megillah that is being constructed is truly global.
Oh, yeah, it's true. And it's a new concept of globalization. You know, a decade and a half ago, they used to refer to it as the Beijing consensus, in contrast to the Washington neoliberal consensus. I would suggest that what is going on is the opposite of the neoliberal globalization that we have seen emerge from Washington and other Western capitals. What we're looking at is a new concept of globalization, not without contradictions, not without problems, not perfect, but it is a move away from the single global hegemon to a multipolar world of fair trade rather than free trade, of investment in infrastructure and other things that build up national and regional economies rather than imperialist aid, which is geared to make nations dependent. And again, we see the possibility of world trade being governed by a basket of currencies rather than the privileged position of the U.S. dollar, which has allowed the United States government to run up these unbelievable debt, which is burdening the American people. And all of that goes back again to this privileged position of the dollar, where all nations, in order to do so-called free trade, have to have in their central banks a certain amount of U.S. paper, of U.S. dollars. And this is something very different going on. The other thing is we might be returning not just to a basket of currencies, which could include the dollar and the euro, but also the yuan and the renminbi, but other currencies. No, you know, we can't say at this point. But a system of fair trade assumes sovereignty and equality of nations. It swears off war as a means of establishing a nation's economic supremacy over weaker nations and weaker regions of the world. With such a development, the possibility of the end to the internecine, internal, and regional conflicts in Africa in particular, most of which, or I would say almost all of which, are promoted by Western nations, the French and the Americans and the English. These are not wars that emerge organically from the African people and from the African continent. The war in the Eastern Congo, which is a Western-financed war to control the resources of the Congo, all of that could come to an end because the economic foundations of these wars for minerals, would come to an end.
Yeah, that particular one has been going on since 1960 with the attempted secession of Katanga Province, which was essentially the attempted theft of the resources of Katanga Province from Congo by the West. You know, when you look at the lineage, the historical lineage of the project of hegemony, what it is essentially last man standing of the, you know, imperialist period. You had a variety of European countries that were, you know, stalking the world, essentially conquering and exploiting the hell out of murdering in its way. But developing, you know, global economic structures based on exploitation, and they fought furiously wars for through the 18th, 19th, 20th centuries that still continue. You're detailing them now by proxy in places like that, if by proxy, in Africa in particular. But the model that is coming into being now is actually something quite different. And we saw a changeover of the model, at least trying to be born, and successfully somewhat in Latin America, beginning with the election of Hugo Chavez in 1998, where they started on this project of regional integration, where they said essentially whatever your political, economic, social system is there is for you to decide, regardless of all of that. We can sit at a table and defend each other's sovereignty, stand up for each other's right of self-determination, and do business and integrate ourselves more deeply and broadly over time. And that was so successful that even right-wing governments that found Venezuela's government, Cuba being at the table, et cetera, intolerable, they were compelled to go to the table because they could bring things back to their constituency at home, like jobs and, you know, bananas and oil and whatever, development things. That is kind of the model that China is offering the world now. You guys have whatever kind of government and local economy that you like. Our interest is in seeing you become more prosperous so you can buy more of our stuff. That's essentially their model, as opposed to the U.S., which is, we're the last man standing. We've got all these weapons. Give us the rest of your stuff, or we're going to blow you up.
Yeah, and see, this, of course, is a regime of globalization based upon finance capital, and not a trade for the sake of meeting the needs of various economies and nations and their people, but at the end of the day, enriching the centers of bank capital in the West and the banks and their institutions. What we're looking at, and you know, a lot of details have to be worked out, is a narrowing of the wealth and income gaps between nations and people, a more evening out of the world economy, and then all of the questions of this historic epoch are put on the table in a new way, including the question of social economic system. which is literally taken off the table as the regime of neoliberal globalization and the militarization of world relationships went forward. We've been in this for about 40 years now.
Yeah.
We might be on the cusp of its reversal. In other words, we might be entering a new epoch, and I often refer to it as the epoch of humanity. We have lived for almost 500 years in the epoch of Europe, the political, economic, military, ideological hegemony of the West, of the Western philosophical, economic, and so on, world. That is what we have lived under. That epoch might be coming to an end. I think it is coming to an end. And that's why I refer to, as I, you know, read about this One Belt, One Road policy, it is the African, Eurasian economic zone. And if you look at a map of the world, that region, which probably contains up to 70% of the world's population, and certainly all of the world's major centers of the world's resources, especially when you include Africa in it, you're looking at what is the natural center of world economy and humanity. And this is it. This is the return to something ancient, but in a very modern post-capitalist era.
Yeah. And that, you know, for, I would say, unrepentant Marxists like myself, the economic is the engine of history. And as we see a new economic order coming into being, one that doesn't seek hegemony of one group over another, but rather to grow the entire game board. All kinds of possibilities can flow from that, you know?
Yeah, to literally grow the world economy, a world economy that is stagnant and has been for many decades. The propaganda of the West kind of disguises this, but the world economy has been in a state of stagnation, defined by growing inequality among nations and regions of the world and growing poverty. That might be coming to an end. The world economy might be on the cusp of growing again and growing rapidly. And places like Africa, whose growth has been held back purposefully for centuries, might enter a period of spectacular rates of growth on the level that China experienced over several decades, 10-12% rates of growth. Indeed, this might be the epoch of peace and prosperity, or the beginning of that epoch, and an end to war. And that end to war will come not just because the imperialist and war makers wake up to the fact that war is not to anybody's benefit, but they wake up to the fact that they are no longer able to win wars. They cannot militarily defeat Iran without inflicting major damage upon their own economies. And in fact, militarily would not be able to defeat Iran. They will not be able to defeat North Korea without shooting themselves in the head economically. You know, and as we've said before, two of the largest economies in the world are in Northeast Asia, China and Japan. I mean, what would war with North Korea mean for the global economy? So, but then they can't defeat these countries anyway, because the technology of war is more evenly spread among nations. So war is not an option. And so the United States, and this is in part what the vote for Trump signified, a pullback from empire. If you want to make America great again, it is not on the basis of imperialist war. Now, there are gestures towards a return to the old neocon policies by the Trump administration. But I think looking at the situation, that the disruption of the old patterns of foreign policy have been so profound, and the trust among imperialist nations has been so tested by Trump's rhetoric, by the attitudes among voting people and working people and middle class people in all of the Euro-American nations, that that they don't want war. They want a pullback from empire. They want, the French want France to be, quote, great again. The British want Britain to be, quote, great again, which can be interpreted as, let us end these wars, let us end these huge military budgets, let us invest in our own infrastructure, in growing our economies, in overcoming this huge inequality between classes and individuals, and certainly in the United States. The unfinished business of American history is the question of white supremacy and the dismantling of the white supremacist social system in this country, which is an epical task for the American people. So here we have a period of instability within the formerly dominant nations, economically, politically, and militarily of the world, great economic stability, while the rest of the world moves forward to create a new world. And without that recognition, you can't understand the world in its totality or the U.S. situation specifically.
Yeah, forgetting for a moment what's developing outside the Western construct. In other words, forgetting the rise of the Eurasian economy and the reconfiguration of all that. We'll come to that in a second. But independently, individually, the Western system is weak in the knees. You have austerity as the only economic policy domestically. And war and occupation as the only foreign policy option. Mm-hmm. And neither of those are suited to the conditions of the world. Certainly, political support erodes as the intensification of austerity presents. We're looking at events just today in Greece, for example. We're looking at the recent elections that took place, of Brexit and Trump. Macron really is just a blip on the screen, but you saw what happened in South Korea, and so with all of that, the thing has trouble standing on its own going forward. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, you have this other phenomenon going on that here's the future of the world, the center of gravity of the world over the next decade, century, perhaps, and the dying order in the West. Being sort of gently pushed out the door, and they are rebelling against that in a way that is really quite frightening. I mean, the attacks on Trump from the first moment that he spoke dissenting lines on foreign policy, talking about NATO being irrelevant and no more regime change, and let's make friends with Russia and China, and acknowledging a multipolar world, which is also an innovation. Even as he says America first, he's talking about there being other people in line, which, you know, to hegemonists, it's, you know, we're exceptional. There is no line. We're not first. We are the line. And this is major stuff when you consider the implication of changes in foreign policy if the United States cannot operate, if there's an acknowledgement among the elite that what you just said, essentially that they can't win these wars, even if they win, they lose. You know, because you mentioned China and Japan, you also have, you have three of the top five economies there, because you also have South Korea, which is huge.
And then the latent
potential of North Korea. You know, I mean, if the Korean Peninsula were integrated into an economic and political unit, in other words, if the U.S. stopped occupying South Korea, there's another major economic powerhouse just like that. So, you know, in that context, so let's say they take Trump down and they go back to the other model. What happens?
Well, can they go back to the other model? Has the train left the station? Has the United States fallen so far behind the fundamental trend of human history that the old model can never work? The neoliberal model cannot work. And the opposite side of this, which many people miss, is that the people of the major capitalist countries are rejecting that model. It has impoverished the American people, the American working class, you know, burdened with unbelievable debt, wages going down, income going down. We're looking at the possibility, you know, we're 8 years out of the Great Recession, but it's about time for another recession. They can't go back to the old model. They cannot return to that. What the United States has used in other countries to maintain its domination is wars that leave countries in chaos. Now that chaos is coming home to roost in political and social conflict, the likes of which we have not seen probably since the American Civil War. But the world will move forward without the United States. We are not the indispensable nation. That is a myth, a worn out and even laughable slogan at best. The world, humanity, is indispensable to itself. There is no indispensable nation. And I would add, when you put China in the mix, you're talking about a world economy that grows without fossil fuels, new investment in green energy sources, new technologies, new infrastructures of mass transportation system. You will be reminded that what the Chinese are building to link the Eurasian sphere is our railroads, rail linkages. Right. We're not talking about air. And sea transportation is but a smaller part of it. We're talking about a new clean global economy. So the United States is falling, further and further behind the trajectory of world social and economic history. We are mired, and the nation is becoming more mired in an internal conflict. And you know, we've mentioned this before, which could look more and more like an internal civil war in this country. You will remember the 1850s in the United States, before the Civil War begins, was a period of a similar political debate and breakdown over the question of slavery, like we are seeing in the United States, over a more broad band of social, racial, economic, class questions. I mean, we're not in the game. We are not in the game anymore.
Professor Montero, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.